The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. Before I get to my very interesting guest today, who's comments will relate to what I'm about to tell you. I want to begin with a major accomplishment, if it can be called that, in the legal reform movement concerning psychiatric drugs and the harm they perpetrate in society. A few months ago, I testified in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, had a hearing in the case of a 16-year-old boy who had abruptly and with no serious provocation, while sitting calmly with two of his friends, stabbed one in the chest, killing him. It turned out that the 16-year-old had been on Prozac for about 3 months before this event. He'd been put on by his primary care doc, and within a few days, he attempted suicide. The primary care doc became legitimately concerned, and the mother became concerned. The boy was referred to a clinic in Canada. He continued to stay on the Prozac, despite the concerns expressed by the primary in writing and by the mom. And on Prozac, he got worse and worse. He became, for the first time, very irritable, very emotionally unstable. He remained suicidal. Although he did not again attempt suicide, he began to have fantasies of violence. He ran away from home. He cut himself. All behaviors that he had never been involved with prior to being put on Prozac. They had trouble getting a psychiatrist to take seriously their concerns. And finally, 17 days before the violent outburst and murder, they got to see a resident in psychiatry, presumably supervised, who, instead of lowering the dose or weaning him off the dose of Prozac, doubled the dose of Prozac. He continued to get worse. The parents were more and more desperate, but didn't know where to turn. And then came this horrendous, violent assault that killed his friend. This past month, the judge rendered his opinion. But to give you the background of this, the big question was, would the young man be tried and sentenced, basically sentenced, as a youth or as an adult? The prosecution wanted him sentenced as an adult. But if he were to be sentenced as a youth, if that were the judge's decision, then his maximum sentence would be 4 years, of which he had already served a good piece. So he wouldn't be in jail for the rest of his life. He'd be out in a few years. The basic debate surrounding this decision involved my presentation of data, my testimony and my very lengthy report in this young man's case. He can't be named because he's a teenager, in which I stated that Prozac literally drove him to commit the murder, and that indeed he had all the symptoms described and warned about by the Canadian Drug Monitoring Agency, Health Canada. And the agency had even warned about danger to others from this drug. And then an individual that well respected in the community, a psychiatrist, gave his testimony, and that was basically the hearing. It was just the two psychiatrists. Well, the judge has now come out and said, and this is the first time in North America we've had a judge take this position, has said that the teen's violence was driven by Prozac, caused by Prozac, and wouldn't have occurred without Prozac. And furthermore, that this young man was no longer a danger to himself or others, and was changed now that he, back to himself now that he was off Prozac and that he could be released. This is an enormous victory, although it's hard to call it a victory in the face of the tragedy, for the family, for the young man, and for the reform movement in psychiatry, which really needs, society really needs, for the courts and society to take more seriously these horrible risks, including suicide and violence from the antidepressants, and indeed from a whole variety of psychiatric drugs. Tomorrow the judge will hold another hearing in which he will determine, that's on October 4th of 2011, for those of you who don't know the date as you're listening to this, perhaps in archive. Tomorrow, October 4th, Tuesday, he will give his opinion, he will give his sentence, he will sentence the young man, and presumably the sentence will be relatively short, given his previous opinion. You can learn more about this by going to my blog on Huffington Post. You can find the blog on Huffington Post, but you can also get to it from my website, breggin.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com. Look down the left-hand side, the table of contents, and you will find Breggin's blog. Click on Breggin's blog, and you'll go right to Huffington Post. Now, today, we are, by coincidence, on a very, on basically the same subject, although in this case, it's the involvement of psychiatric drugs, and in particular, the antidepressant Celexa, in a suicide. My guest today is Ying-Ying Chang. She is the mother of Iris Chang, who is no longer with us. Iris Chang was an internationally known historian. She delved into some of the most horrific episodes of the 20th century. If I'm conscious of psychiatry, Iris Chang was the conscience of the world. One of her books, her second book, was The Rape of Nanking, in which she called The Forgotten Holocaust of World War II. That was a 1997 book. She was researching her fourth book, The Bataan Death March, at the time of her suicide. Her mother, Ying Ying, has written the book, The Woman Who Could Not Forget, Iris Chang Before and Beyond the Rape of Nanking. It is her mother's opinion, her strong opinion, that her daughter committed suicide much more as a result of her exposure to psychiatric drugs than her exposure to the horrific aspects of the 20th century that she wrote about. In brief, just to get a couple of basic facts out, and then we'll go to Ying-Ying Chang. Her daughter had a breakdown, was hospitalized, diagnosed apparently with a brief psychotic reaction. She was discharged, and when put on Celexa, became abruptly suicidal 2 days afterward. She was also on antipsychotic drugs. She went back on Prozac after a week or two. Not on Prozac, on Celexa after a week or two. And her mother believes that that's what led to her suicide in the following week. These times are not exact, but basically on Celexa became suicidal, stopped taking it, went back on Celexa, became suicidal, and killed herself. Although we don't know, because no one had very close contact with her, whether she continued the Celexa after starting it. It's not really critical because the antidepressant to exposures like that, even if she stopped for a week, could have been sufficient to drive her over the edge. But clearly it's a complicated case of a woman who had a breakdown before going on psychiatric drugs and who was dealing with horrific materials. I want to welcome to Joe Ying Ying Chang. Hello.
Hello, yes. I'm here.
Did I give an accurate summary?
Yes, yes. I think Iris, my daughter, was famous for her second book, The Rape of Nanking, The Forgotten Holocaust of World War II. At the time, the book was published in 1997 and become the best-selling on the best-selling list of New York Times. And the book has been translated to several languages and also become international bestseller. And also because because my book called The Woman Could Not Forget, it's because she is continuous campaign to ask the Japanese government for a formal apology and a compensation. So this really her book make a tremendous impact on the global redress movement regarding the imperial Japanese war crimes in the Asian during the World War II. But, you know, when she died, you know, as 7 years after this book. So after she died, a lot of media said because of the subject she's writing. But to my opinion and also my husband's opinion, we talk about this for a long time, we don't feel so because after the book was published, she was moved on and have another book. Her third book is called Chinese in American. It's about, you know, Chinese American immigration experience, which is not very, you know, as bad as the book, The Rape of Nanking. So she's okay. So that's 7 years after The Rape of Nanking. So it's her suicide.
Excuse me, though, Ying Ying. Wasn't she then working, though, on the Bataan Death March at the time of her death?
Right, but yes. And after
depressing stuff.
Yes, yes. After the third book published in 2003, she was working on another book, as Dr. Brinken mentioned. It's a gruesome book again. It's about the atrocity the Japanese Imperial Army committed in Philippines on the POW of United States stationed in Philippines. It is even worse than The Rape of Nanking. But even that, in my book, I still think she's a strong woman. You know, she never feel the threatening about that kind of subject. But, you know, the things has changed after the last half year, 6 months. It's really different because especially the last 3 months, you know, before she died, her character was changed. That's why I want to talk to about this. So she never thought suicide is a way out. So she, how could she was so become, has this suicide ideation or called suicide behavior or thoughts. That's completely, precisely coincided with the time she was taking antipsychotic and antidepressants at the time when the doctor prescribed to her.
Well, so, I really do believe yes. from the outline that you've given to me from the medical records that it's more likely than not and really fairly certain that the psychiatric medication tipped her over and drove her over the edge. And her suicide notes, which really speak of just this overwhelming anxiety that she cannot control, not
yes.
guilt, not
yes.
guilt, which would be the reaction you'd have from perhaps wanting to kill yourself from being so involved in these horrific crimes against humanity. The anxiety, I think, is a characteristic of these drugs as they drive people over the edge, particularly these SSRI antidepressants. But, you know, life is complicated, and in many of the cases I see, there's more complication. The drugs are like the final straw, and I think there's room to see the drugs as the final straw while also seeing how much this young woman, she was 30, how old when she died, 34?
36.
You know, that so much was going on. And I know as a person who's faced some pretty horrific stuff myself, you know, in reform work, it can feel overwhelming at times. It can feel horribly overwhelming and terribly alone at times. But I do agree with you from what you've told me, from my familiarity, which is not deep with her story, that without the drugs, she would probably be alive today, without the psychiatric drugs. Just like that young man who, much more out of the blue, with much less stress behind him, you know, that I talked about at the beginning of the show, ended up becoming suicidal immediately after starting Prozac and then eventually violent. So
yes.
I'm really with you on that.
Yes. And, you know, because I'm a biochemist in training, although I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but because I have a biochemical background, so after she died, I really look into that. And I also have a very detailed record of her, the medication. So I found out that the first attempt at suicide, she was on the September 21st. And that's 2 days after she took Celexan. And then she stopped after, you know, a couple of weeks. She stopped a couple of weeks. And then she restarted again. And then as October 28th, that's 3 days after she took Celexan again. And then she went to gun shop. And then after, like 12 days later, she committed suicide successfully. This time.
Yeah.
And first I have to stress, in our family, we never had a gun. And then she was a person, never, you know, when she was, before the take this drug, she never thinking suicide is a way out. And she always give me emails because we are very intimate. She sometimes commented, how could people kill herself or himself? So that's why she changed her character. And then how could, so this is the medication record, was her attempt at suicide, and then the finally commiserate. So, so violent and so short. So, you know, this is a chemical reaction. I mean, as a chemist, and it cannot be, people can change a behavior so fast. Only 3 months after the psychotic and the psychiatric drug and antidepressant, and then the behaviors changed, and so that's why I finally realized Dr. Brinken's books, and I read a lot of, and I met Dr. Martin Thatcher in Harvard Medical School, and also I talked to read some other books. I realized, and then looking back. So that's what I carefully describe in my book, in the last two chapters, and the epilogue in my book.
Yes, let me let our listeners know. She's talking about meeting with Martin Teicher, T-E-I-C-H-E-R, who is a psychiatrist at Harvard, who wrote one of the first papers on a series of cases of compulsive suicidality.
Yes.
And who later said he was completely misled by Eli Lilly and company when they told him that they had no such data in their files that the drug could possibly do that. But his initial work was very, very important, though he later, like so many people in the establishment, just sort of let go of that very hot potato and went on to do other things. Ying, you mentioned that your daughter did have some kind of a breakdown before she started on the psychiatric drugs, and you were telling me you thought that was due to just fatigue, extreme fatigue from the work she was doing?
Yeah, okay. What do you mean? What she was doing before broke down in Louisville, Kentucky. You know, she was, as you know, she was working on the fourth book about Bataan Death March. And all those survivors was live in the Midwest state, like Kentucky, Ohio, Wisconsin, Illinois. So she scheduled to meet them, and then she wanted to do oral, okay, interview. But before she went to this trip, for several days before that, because of preparation of the trip, she was very intense research. And didn't sleep well and eat well. But also, unfortunately, at that time, she discovered her son, Christopher, also has some symptom of autism. And so that's why she also, on top of the research of the book, she is going to writing, and she also doing research on autism. So she was continuous on the computer and doing reading, and so she didn't sleep very well and didn't eat well either. So before that, and then she broke down in the hotel as soon as she arrived in Louisville, Kentucky. At the time, so we immediately flew there to bring her back. And at the time, the doctor diagnosed her is a brief reactive psychosis. And so what she saw on the TV, she saw it has some horrible pictures, but now she saw it is someone, have a wild room, and so showed a picture to threaten her. And but this is, we don't know, really don't know, is it because what she saw is real or not real, or someone, wired her TV to show some pictures, right? That will be never known. But anyway, the doctor prescribed risperidone, the antipsychotic drug, 2 milligrams. And since then, she took that. And then later when, after she came back, one of the psychiatrists prescribed Abilify instead of risperidone. I think the starting of Abilify is really the turning point. I think she become very drowsy. She was very sleepy and has a very severe side effect on the joint pain, and I can see her rigid in the expression. And at that time, I still didn't know those antipsychotic drug has such a big impact on patients, because we never have a patient in our family, mental illness. So we never know. We always follow the doctor. So, and then because she has depression a little bit, it's not really serious, but the doctor gave her Celexine. Last 2 days after that, and then she has first suicide attempt. So, this is things get worse and later on. And then she refused. She didn't want to take medicine. And then she stopped it for a couple of weeks. And then the doctor wanted her restart again. And I realized from all the reading now, the most risk, dangerous time is the initial phase. And also, you change the dosage, you stop and restart, which is the most dangerous period. But we didn't know, not very much at the time.
Right.
And that's the how,
A couple of thoughts, Ying Ying, on this. First, I agree with your analysis about the drugs. I really do. In my own experience doing reform work, it is really easy to get to become what people call paranoid. And your daughter was really young when she started writing these books, and was still young when she committed suicide. And the, by the way, as an aside, women rarely shoot themselves as a method of suicide. That kind of violence is usually male suicide. But when taking antidepressant drugs, women become more violent in their suicidal attempts. But talking about the tendency to get paranoid is very easy because you don't really know what powerful forces are doing to get in the way of your work and to stop you from your work. And when she was taking on the Japanese government and taking on the groups within Japan that still didn't want to assume any guilt for World War II or for the horrendous atrocities perpetrated against the Chinese when they invaded China, and then against the Americans and other people, the Koreans. I mean, tremendous atrocities against Koreans. Well, there were a lot of people who wouldn't have wanted her going on with her work. And so it's entirely possible that either from some higher up authority or just from some loose cannon that people were trying to harm her, to monitor her work. And it's just really difficult when you're in that position and feeling alone and isolated and taking on the world. Very difficult to begin to clearly separate out in your own mind reality from non-reality when it comes to your fears. And especially, I think, when you're younger and you're just starting to do this and you're relatively alone. So it's certainly understandable to me that your daughter would have gotten into a situation where she appeared to be psychotic. One other thing about that is that one of the easiest things for an experienced and somewhat courageous therapist to deal with are these brief psychotic episodes or these brief breaks with reality when they occur. I've seen them in my practice from culture shock. I've seen them in my practice from, deep losses. And a person who has an acute break and who has been before that a really high-functioning person like your daughter, you can often help that person with the first session, really engaging them about their life and helping them to rebuild some trust and giving them a sense that they have somebody they can really talk to. And you can see that psychosis melt away in days under those conditions that I've just described without prescribing any medication. But when you then instead prescribe medication, you're going to make the therapy process virtually impossible, and you're going to produce chronicities. So your daughter probably could have been just helped over that hump very easily by somebody who knew what they were doing. And that makes it, of course, an even more horrible tragedy.
Yes. Yes.
We're going to take a break in a couple of 2 minutes. Do you have some thoughts just to summarize some thoughts before we take our break?
Okay. Yeah, I think what you said is very good. I really indeed she become paranoid is because about her subject, and she really thinking some people like a right winger in Japan was after her, or because or this country. Some, higher order, So, I totally agree with you. And actually, a lot of people told me so, too. And also, the violent ending of her life using gun is very unusual for a woman, for women. That's all people told me. So I think we never own a gun, and she never touched a gun before. How could she did that? This is my conclusion is because drug influence. Yeah, that's my conclusion, yes.
We are talking with Ying Ying Chang, the mother of Iris Chang, who took on some of the greatest atrocities in her books, including the rape of Nanking, and who was writing a book on the Bataan Death March at the time that she had what was diagnosed as a brief psychotic break, which turned into a disaster, a tragedy, and a suicide, almost certainly as a result of exposure to psychiatric drugs, and in particular, antipsychotic drugs and antidepressant drugs. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. We'll come back in a few minutes to talk about and celebrate the life of Iris Iris Chang. Let's go to break.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. Encouraged to talk to you some more about the life of Iris Chang with her mom, who survives her, Ying Ying Chang. For those of you who don't know, it might be helpful to know why I identify so much with Iris Chang. You know, I've been doing reform work in psychiatry since I was an 18-year-old and ran a state mental hospital program at Harvard as a volunteer for 4 years. When I became a psychiatrist, I realized lobotomy was coming back, and I carried out an international campaign which stopped lobotomy almost dead in its tracks around the world, so that from many, many projects all over the world, we went to the handful that we still have today. During that time, the degree of attack on me from the medical profession and the media was at times absolutely overwhelming, absolutely overwhelming. To find myself thinking that everyone would be on my side in stopping lobotomy, to finding that the American Psychiatric Association had literally put a target on my back in terms of figuring out how to get me. I actually have letters, eventually got letters, when I sued one of the psychiatrists, we got letters between the leaders of the American Psychiatric Association, the president, the treasurer, so on, about getting Bragan. Eventually, I began to take on the establishment over psychiatric drugs, involuntary treatment, and electroshock treatment. And again, the attacks and the undermining and the threats, even threats against my life, were quite times demoralizing. I had to learn to grow with it. In the mid-1980s, they went after my medical license, not for anything to do with my patients, but for remarks I made on Oprah Winfrey. All of this, by the way, is documented with media coverage and historical data in a book about my life called The Conscience of Psychiatry, the reform work of Peter R. Bragan. I bring this up, and I won't go into it in any greater detail right now, other than to say that it was extraordinarily difficult, and especially before the mid-1980s when my wife Ginger joined me. And I can easily see how a young woman would get ground down by taking on, as Iris Chang did, huge, powerful authorities like the government of Japan, like the individuals in Japan who did not want the atrocities committed by Japan during World War II to get further attention, who didn't want to have to apologize and make redress and try to somehow, take responsibility for what had been done. It was really easy for me to understand how somebody would become more and more distressed and disturbed, and then tired and exhausted and worn out, as Iris Chang's mother has vividly described to us. So all this is very dear to me in terms of what I've been through, and I hadn't really even thought about it until this break time during the show, how dear to me this is. I think my wife Ginger realized it much earlier, when she wrote about Iris Chang in the newsletter of our empathic therapy organization. I want to read something that Iris wrote about herself and her life, but probably because this is so much on my mind, I've misplaced what she wrote. So let me bring on her mom, Ying Ying. Hi, Ying Ying. I was going to get the power of one quote.
Yes. Yeah, because I was invited several places to give a talk. Because, I mean, the book is on the Iris's life, but it really is because what she really inspired me by her writing and also her speech. While I was writing my book, I keep reading, you know, her emails or letters to me over the years, plus her speech she was giving all over the country, and she was very all those speeches so inspired. I think you mean the one she delivered in 1998 into her high school commencement, right? She talked about the power of one.
I found it. So let me read it. It's just incredible, and it's something that I've tried to talk about many times, but I don't think ever quite this well. She wrote, and this was to her high school. She was invited back to give a talk at her high school?
Yes, she was invited back to, they gave her an award, and then she was the keynote speaker to encourage the graduate class of 1998.
Okay, and this is what she wrote. Please believe in the power of one. One person can make an enormous difference in the world. One person, actually one idea, can start a war or end one, or subvert an entire power structure. One discovery can cure a disease or spawn new technology to benefit or annihilate the human race. You, as one individual, can change millions of lives. Think big. Do not limit your vision, and do not ever compromise your dreams or ideals. What a great thing to say to young people, and how different from your typical self-fulfillment speech that's usually given, I think, to students. This is about taking responsibility. And I like that your daughter juxtaposed that you can do good, you can create diseases or technologies that will destroy, or you can create great good things, cure diseases, change society.
Mm-hmm.
One person. It's really something for us to remember.
Yes. That's why, actually this is the driving force behind me too. It's taken me 5 or 6 years to finish this memoir. And I keep thinking, she said, one person can change the world. And although you think you are so small, but actually you can do something to reform the world. And I think Dr. Bricken, you also did so tremendously in this aspect. I was admire you. So when I read your books, I thought, I just immediately conclude. I think a lot of things you describe in the medication madness just apply to the case of Iris. And I was so fortunate to understand. I mean, there's a whole bunch of people like you are now, starting to reform this kind of practice in our psychiatrist field.
Tell us more about your daughter. How do you think she ever became so courageous and determined and moral and just determined to do something about her ethics rather than just complain, as most of us do?
Well, actually, it's very hard to answer this question. I really don't know. I mean, we as parents, we just do as example to her, but we really didn't anticipate that she was so dedicated. She working very hard. She have such a high standard by herself. And that's why in my book, I just present to the readers that how she grew up, And really, we didn't really particular to emphasize anything because my husband and I are immigrant into this country as a student. We got a scholarship from Harvard University. My husband got a PhD in physics. I got a PhD in biological chemistry. And then we, start out to do the teaching and research career in the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. We have been there for, you know, 30 years until we retired. Now we moved to the Bay Area of California. And we, you know, we are academic, and we are immigrants. And I think I describe a lot in my book. I really, I think this is different children, you know, different child have a different gene makeup, or also maybe the motivation is different. But she was show her eager to learn, her curiosity, and very dedication to the work and working hard. I mean, I don't think we teach her. But she will probably some part of just got by herself, you know, learn, and she liked to read from when she was very little. And she really feel words is something eternal, she said. In my book, I quote many words she said that she really want to preserve the history. And actually, one thing she said to me was I move so much is she said that I'm to read a couple of her quotes. She said, you know, man, let's see, you know, you can, the man can die twice, the people die twice, once as mortals and once in memory. And she really think people die twice, but when you die, it's the body first die. But on the other hand, if you forget that person, if you lost the memory of that person, that's truly death of that person. That's why she was so determined to preserve the history of those voices and to preserve the truth and the justice of the history. And so dedicated and amazing me too.
Now, did she grow up speaking Chinese so that she was fluent in it when she became interested in the rape of Nanking and those atrocities?
Yeah, well, things like that. When she, before 5 years old, my husband and I decided she should learn Chinese. So we talk and, you know, read her in Chinese. But she also learned English, of course. And outside the home, we speak English. And then when she was 5 years old, we established a Chinese school or Chinese class in Champaign-Urbana. And, you know, it's not very many immigrant family with her age, but we have to recruit like 10 students in on Saturday, Sunday. We teach them Chinese. So she learned Chinese at home and writing and speaking. And she was very curious about her family background, the history, the Chinese history. And that's why I, in my book, I said that she didn't have an identity problem. She always very proud to be a Chinese American. And also she was so curious why we have to be staying in U.S., not going back. So, of course, we will tell her during the dinner table about our experience, our parents' experience during the Second World War, how my grandparents was escaping, you know, the Japanese invasion. We have to move from the Nanking, Shanghai, you know, eastern part of China to the southwest part, China, Chongqing, which is the, where is the capital of the war capital of China. And then, you know, all those history. So she was, you know, willing to listen, and she really asked a number provoking, you know, questions. So she learned a lot of before she wrote this book, actually. So I keep in tell people the Rape of Nanking, this book, is not accidental. It's the accumulation of many years. She heard those stories, and she wanted to find out about it. So that's how she determined to write it.
What was her education?
Her, she attended, you know, elementary school and high school in Champaign-Urbana, and then she attended University of Illinois, first majoring in math and computer science. And then on the junior year, she really loved writing literature, so she switched to journalism. Actually, this is a story I was, you know, describing in my book. And then she thought that we want her to be a scientist, but actually we really not this kind of a person. I keep tell the audience, sometimes I give a speech. I'm not a tiger mom, as you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
For people who don't know what that is, there was this remarkable New York Times article about Chinese tiger moms who drive their children to success at all costs. So you were not a tiger mom.
Right. Actually, my book just published at the time this, book was come out about tiger mom. So people are, interested in me. Whether I was a tiger mom. I'm not, because actually my husband and I was really, let the children decide what she really liked. So when she came back when the junior year in college, she said that she really loved, writing and literature. So I said, my husband said, why not you switch to literature? So finally she was so surprised, and she was very happy. Actually later on, she was very grateful to us, allow her to choose her career, to follow her interest. And that's what, in my book I described that. So she was majoring in journalism and graduated in 1989 from University of Illinois. And then later on, she worked with Associated Press in Chicago, and then later on, Chicago Tribune, the newspaper, for a short period of time. And then she got a scholarship in Johns Hopkins. So she got a writing MA, a master degree in Johns Hopkins. From there, she started to write her first book, because she was commissioned to write the first book, The Thread of Silkworm. It's about the rocket scientist, Dr. Chen Xuesen. That is the idea of the publisher, because they're looking for a Chinese has both background, English and Chinese background. And her professor recommended her to the publisher. So that's how she started the first book and started her writing career.
Now, has writing this book about your daughter changed your life?
Oh, yeah. Yes. You mean change her life? Yes.
Your life.
My life. Yeah. You mean the...
You're writing your book about...
Yeah. Of course, because I follow her so much, because my daughter and I are so close together, and she always... writing us many emails. That's why my book contain many her letters and emails. So you can see our relation, the mother-daughter's relations are very intimate. And she really inspired me. And I follow her career, writing career. And so I learned a little bit about publishing too. And that's why I thought when she died, no one really know who is Iris Chen. I mean, her family background, because she's a very private person. But I thought that she should let people know her whole life if people want to understand her. Besides, her son, Christopher, when she died, he only 2 years old. He will never, know her, his mom. So I thought I must write this book.
What do you think are the lessons of your daughter's incredible life? She's like a meteor, and then she's gone. What lessons are there?
Well, I think we can learn a lot of things from her. Of course, positive side, hardworking, and follow your dreams, your ambition, and never... that compromise your dream, all those things, as you read and as I said. But of course, she worked too hard. That's why, at the end, she, a person have a limited energy or time. You cannot work too hard and then ignore your physical wellness. So I think if she not worked that hard and, maybe, the lesson learned is you have to balance your career and also your life. So I think if she relaxed a little and then just, when she was so exhausted at the end, before she broke down, if she realized her life was, going to that stressful, she should be slowed down. So that probably is a lesson to learn from this, my book. Yeah.
You know, again, identifying with her in many ways, when you feel that you're supposed to do something, when you feel like you're almost commanded to take on certain issues because you are able to and because it needs to be done, it's very hard then to set limits on yourself. You know, my wife and I feel that our reform work is something that we are really obligated to do, that we're supposed to do, and it's the center in many ways of our lives. So that we don't distinguish between our career and our lives, our work, the work we do, is all very integrated, from my doing, you know, my psychiatric practice to the books that some of us have written together, that some of which we have written together, to the organization that she runs and that I help run, and to so many things we do that are around reform. And it is our life. And when something is your life, it becomes very easy to overwork yourself, to begin to think that you must do this and you must do that, and to not have the perspective that our lives are indeed brief, that the world will go on without us, that we need to find, as you said, a balance in what we are doing. So it's a constant struggle for me, even at age 75, to keep coming back to that balance of living a full life and not overdoing this work that both my wife Ginger and I believe is so important. So I can really understand how your daughter would have overdone it for a brief time. But I believe if we lived in a society in which it was understood that things like a psychotic breakdown, that is just, you know, losing yourself, losing track of reality, feeling ultimately just overwhelmed, that this is a part of life, and it's a part of a passionate life, and is more likely to happen to somebody who is passionate and courageous and brave and dedicated, that your daughter just could have been helped right through that period of time without ever killing herself, and without ever really getting worse and worse, that she just could have had a respite and encouragement and help. And I just hope that psychiatry will eventually, or society, maybe it's got to be society, will eventually realize that there are so many better alternatives to helping people through crises than putting them in mental hospitals and giving them psychoactive drugs. And I think your work is really going to contribute to that realization. I'm sure it has already, and I'm just so glad you're doing your work that you're doing. But I'll bet you get to the point now and again where you overdo it, don't you?
So, yes, I thought that you're absolutely right, because it's how true you said. It's because now I was invited to many places to give a talk, and then my husband had to say, you gotta have to stop sometimes, because otherwise, you know, our life, you know, will be too much involved in this process, and my relative also feels so. And I think, as you said, my work and then my life now, you cannot separate anymore. It seems that's all my life now. But I guess some place you gotta have to stop. But on the other hand, the other side call me, you know, I have this experience I want to share with the public. I really want the people know, you know, the dangers, the potential danger, side of a serious side effect of the antidepressant and the psychotic and the psychiatric drugs. And maybe I should also, the Asian population should be very aware. The dosage now, you know, the doctor prescribed, maybe it's too high. There's a racial difference. I think I discussed in my book, too.
Yes, and there certainly has been work on those genetic issues.
Yeah.
Listen, I want to just thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a wonderful hour with Ying Ying Chang talking about her daughter, Iris Chang. And as we finish, I'm going to finish with reading once again these words, which mean so much to me and which guide my life as well. Iris Chang saying, please believe in the power of one. One person can make an enormous difference in the world. One person, actually one idea, can start a war or end one, or subvert an entire power structure. One discovery can cure a disease or spawn new technology to benefit or annihilate the human race. You, as one individual, can change millions of lives. Think big. Do not limit your vision, and do not ever compromise your dreams or ideals. Thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show, Mrs. Chang.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.